From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. More than 110,000 state regulations help slow North Carolina's economic growth. That's the assessment from an expert at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. You'll hear his concerns. Meanwhile, leading North Carolina economists believe this state is likely to see economic benefits from the new federal tax law. You'll learn what they had to say at a recent economic forecast forum. A long-running legal fight between the State Board of Education and the State Rules Review Commission heads to the state Supreme Court soon. You'll hear details. And we'll learn why the next state budget battle is likely to focus on the level of government spending growth. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
Parents of school-age kids who are looking for an alternative to public school may be eligible for North Carolina's Opportunity Scholarship. The scholarships are awarded to parents with modest incomes and can be used to pay tuition and fees at a private school that better fits the child's needs. Now, with the application period set to open on February 1st, we decided we would invite an expert on the scholarship to join us. He, of course, is a familiar voice to Carolina Journal Radio listeners. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, you are very high on the scholarship program. Why?
Well, this provides an opportunity for students with generally low incomes to be able to attend a school that better meets their needs. And this is something that we see more and more across the nation, about 26 school choice voucher programs here across the nation. And we have two here in North Carolina, including the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Every year, there are more and more applicants for a limited pool of money to be able to take it to a private school. And really, when we talk about private school, we're not talking about usually a boarding school or anything expensive like that, but we're talking about a local, small private school that is an alternative, sometimes the only alternative, to the district system.
Who can apply for the scholarship?
Well, these are generally students whose families would be considered free and reduced lunch students. So there is an income cap. It depends on how many individuals are in the household. And that information is available from the State Education Assistance Authority. And that is an important point to make, because a lot of people seem to think that the Department of Public Instruction or the Department of Non-Public Education run the Opportunity Scholarship Program, but it's actually the State Education Assistance Authority. And they have income guidelines on their website that allow parents to determine whether their child qualifies for an Opportunity Scholarship.
I'm so glad you brought up that agency that really administers the application process of for Opportunity Scholarships. And here's the website, ncseaa.edu. Again, that stands for North Carolina State Education Assistance Authority. So then, once the application period is over, how do I find out if I'm a winner?
Well, first of all, they have to determine eligibility. There are plenty of individuals that apply that don't meet the income eligibility requirements or don't qualify for some other reason, such as they didn't spend their previous school year in a public school, which is one of the requirements. So they determine eligibility, and they find typically that there are a good number of applicants that aren't eligible, unfortunately, for the program. They want to be able to participate, but they don't. So it'll give you some hard numbers. numbers on it. For the last year, we saw over 10,000 applicants, but so far this year, only around 6,800 have received opportunity scholarships. Now, some of those are students that decide at the last minute that they don't want to make the jump to the private school, but a good many of them are individuals that want a scholarship, desperately need a scholarship, but for whatever reason don't qualify.
Why is it limited to families of low or modest income?
Well, this was a decision made by the Republican General Assembly when they created the Opportunity Scholarship Program that they would target it to those who need it the most. I think some of the concern was that you would have, if you opened it up to everyone, wealthy parents taking a voucher they really don't need to pay for a private school that they can afford. And so the idea was to make sure that those who needed it the most, that is low-income households, had access to the public funds. And we're not talking about a tremendous amount of money, only $4,200 maximum scholarships. And on average, the State Education Assistance Authority usually awards around $4,000 because they award what is required of the school and not necessarily the maximum amount. But not only that, the scholarship program overall spends around $14 million a year compared to a $13 billion public school budget. So it's a very, very small part of an education budget, let alone our entire $50 billion state budget.
Terry, in the past, we've really heard from some parents and some grandparents who've been raising children, and they just have such compelling stories about kids who are trapped in schools that are failing the child. Sometimes a classroom or a school may work just fine for a lot of the kids, but for individual reasons, it's just not working for some of these children. And these parents and grandparents, they seem to be the program's best advocate when you hear their stories.
They really are. When you talk to them, you realize that they look for schools based on more than just academics. They want their child to be safe. They want their child's school to be near where they live. There's any number of reasons why they choose to send their child to a private school. And safety, I think, being just as important as student performance, because you want that child to thrive in an academic environment where that child doesn't feel threatened. But you find these amazing stories from parents and grandparents who have seen poverty throughout their life and educational opportunities limited. Generation after generation, this is an opportunity for their child that they probably never imagined, because they never thought that they would have the means to be able to provide a private school tuition and fees for their child. And here's the state stepping in and giving them that opportunity after generations of public schools that frankly didn't always meet their needs, didn't always give them that upward mobility that we expected them to.
You know, Terry, the past few days, those of us who are advocates for empowering parents through choice have been commemorating National School Choice Week. North Carolina has an array of options these days for parents, and sometimes I think parents may not realize how far North Carolina has come over the last decade or more.
It's absolutely remarkable. Our homeschool population, for example, in the last 10 years has increased 79%. We had just 8 years ago, we had half the number of charter school students than we have now. We have 173 charter schools enrolling over 100,000 students. And charter schools are public schools that provide some flexibility to parents and to teachers. We also have private schools, 100,000 kids in private schools. Now, of course, only a portion of them receive any sort of state aid that allows them to go there. But we have a huge private school population in North Carolina with a lot of opportunities for kids, if they qualify for a voucher, to be able to go to one of the 700-plus schools, private schools that we have here. So when you put it all together, we have well over 325,000 students pursuing some sort of choice, and that doesn't include the private or the public school students that sometimes have choices through magnet programs and other type of district choices.
It looks like there's something new that we're going to start hearing about as well, called an education savings account. What is that?
An education savings account is an account that a parent can use for educational expenses beyond just tuition and fees. So there can be expenses for speech therapy or any other sort of qualified educational expense they can use to meet the needs of their child. When this comes online later this year, parents will have a $9,000 account for their special needs child to be able to use in a variety of educational and academic settings, not just a private school.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies. Terry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Nearly 110,000 state regulations are weighing down North Carolina's economy. That was one of the messages our next guest delivered recently to state lawmakers. James Broll is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He co-authored a recent study of regulations in North Carolina. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is part of a project that you're doing looking at regulations in various states across the country. How does North Carolina stack up?
Sure. So we have a project at Mercatus Center called State Reg Data, and it's an effort to quantify how much regulation exists across the 50 states. And right now we've looked at about 14 states so far. It takes a little time because we use text analysis software to analyze state codes. So it's a bit of a time-consuming process. And we've come up with estimates for how many regulatory restrictions are in each of the state's codes we've looked at so far. And these are instances of words like shall, must, may not, prohibited. And North Carolina has about 110,000 of these regulatory restrictions in the code. But that actually turns out to be about in the middle of the pack as far as the states we've looked at so far. So at the high end, New York has the most we've seen so far with about 307,000 restrictions, so almost three times what North Carolina has. On the other end is Arizona that has about 64,000 restrictions. So that's quite a bit smaller than North Carolina's code. So you guys are about in the middle.
So some people will hear that and say, well, that's good to be in the middle of the pack. But one of your messages to lawmakers was that even though that fact might sound good, having 110,000 regulations might not necessarily be the best thing for the economy.
Right. The accumulation of all these rules on the books can really be a drag on economic growth. There's an economist in Washington, D.C. at the Progressive Policy Institute. His name's Michael Mandel. And he likens the effects of regulation on the economy to dropping pebbles in a stream. So the first pebble may not have any noticeable impact, but 1,000 pebbles might start to slow the stream. 100,000, 500,000 pebbles might block up the stream altogether, even though that last pebble really was insignificant in its own right. And this is how the accumulation of regulations can really slow the economy.
Does the research show much detail about where these regulations are starting to accumulate? Are there particular areas in North Carolina that are much more heavily regulated than others?
Yes. So about half of the restrictions in the North Carolina Administrative Code come from just two titles of the code. One is the Environmental Quality title, which has about 26,800 restrictions in it. And the second is Health and Human Services, which has about almost 24,000 restrictions in it. The third largest title is Occupational licensing boards and commissions. And so these are everything else is a lot smaller than those areas. So health, environment, and licensing tend to be the dominant areas in North Carolina.
I think most people listening to us would say North Carolina needs to have some rules. You can't just let everything run amok. Your message to lawmakers, I think, is probably that let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater, but perhaps look at ways to scale back the rules we don't really need.
Absolutely. So I would say there's an important distinction to be made between red tape, which is really the unnecessary regulations that are just kind of barriers to entrepreneurship and innovation and maybe don't really serve any useful purpose, or maybe they once served a useful purpose and that problem has gone away over time just as society evolves. And then the other kinds of regulations are the justified ones that are in place. They're protecting public health, safety, and the environment. And the key is finding a way to create strong institutions where the regulators have the incentives to go back and constantly be carefully evaluating the rules under their purview to see which are working and which aren't.
We are speaking with James Broll, research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And I just want to return to something you just mentioned. North Carolina, within the last few years, put in place a regulatory review process, and the official name is sunset with periodic review. And what it really means is that all these rules have to go back in front of the rulemakers every 10 years to make sure that they're needed. Sounds like that fits in exactly with what you're talking about.
That's right. So I think sunset reviews are this is basically an expiration date that's tied to all regulations. So they will expire automatically unless someone reauthorizes them, either the regulatory agency or the legislature. And usually there's some kind of evaluation process that happens before they sunset to determine whether the rule is effective or not. And so these are a good way to look back and assess whether the rules on the books are working. Now, they don't guarantee that the look back effort will be done carefully or that serious analysis will be done, like cost-benefit analysis, to determine whether the regulation's creating more benefits than costs. So there's a danger it can become kind of a box-checking exercise where all the rules are just renewed. But there is some evidence that sunset provisions are associated with lower levels of regulation overall.
Another thing that legislators have been talking about in recent years is this idea of ensuring that the costliest rules have to be approved by elected lawmakers and not just by unelected bureaucrats. Is that something that would fit in well with reducing the regulatory burden?
So that has more to do with new regulations in general. So this is often goes that kind of policy is often goes under the name the RAINS Act, because that's what the federal version is referred to. It hasn't been implemented at the federal level, but it's been proposed. And essentially what would happen is the costliest regulations would have to get approval from the legislature and perhaps the governor as well before they could go into effect. So it returns some power to the legislature. So often people who are very concerned that the legislature has delegated a lot of lawmaking power to regulatory agencies who would then just use that to regulate more and more. They often like this kind of policy because it brings back some accountability to the legislature, who's more accountable to the voters. The downside is that often deregulatory actions would also get kind of caught up in this process. So any large deregulatory action has to go through the rulemaking process typically. And so while this RAINS Act kind of policy creates a higher bar for new regulations, it also creates a higher bar for modifying or removing or improving old regulations.
Your report throws a lot of information at lawmakers. What's the bottom line message that you hope they take out of it?
Mostly I just want to provide them with information that I don't think that they've had before. So this is really a first of its kind effort to quantify how much regulation exists in a state and be able to compare to your neighbors. So this is new information, and I hope that they use it to carefully think about whether the amount of regulation in North Carolina is a good amount, whether they should have more regulation or less regulation. But now they have information they didn't have. And in addition, accompanying our report, we create an Excel file that is basically a catalog of where all the words and all the regulatory restrictions are in the North Carolina Code. You can see it broken down by title, subtitle, chapter, et cetera. And I think that this information could be useful to track how the level of regulation, both in aggregate but also by title, is changing over time.
You've been listening to James Broll, research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The State Board of Education and the State Rules Review Commission have been battling in court since 2014. The source of the fight? The state school board believes its rules are not subject to outside review. Rules Review Commission Chairman Garth Dunklin recently offered an update on the case for state lawmakers.
Why is this case important as a general matter? The bottom line is the entire concept of the administrative code from a rulemaking process is about sunshine and process. Making sure there's an opportunity for the public to have input, to know what rules are being made, for that process to be plain and open to everybody, and for the result to be within the authority of the people adopting the rules and clear and understandable by the public. It's a pretty straightforward concept. So generally, that's the concept that's at play. The State Board of Education filed a lawsuit back in 2014 to say that they don't have to do that. Chapter 150 115C2, we think, says clearly to the contrary, because it is the elementary and secondary education statute, and it says very clearly to our way of thinking that rules enacted governing this subject matter are to follow the Administrative Procedures Act. The North Carolina State Board of Education filed a declaratory action in 2014 saying they don't fall within the definition of an agency. This is not an appropriate statute. It's as applied, unconstitutional. The legislature is the only body that has the authority to do this, and that they don't have to comply with Chapter 150B. We have begged to differ now for almost 4 years.
Doug Glenn explained to lawmakers that the case has taken twists and turns, with each side winning at different levels of the state court system.
It has gone to a Superior Court ruling that ruled in favor of the State Board of Education, saying that they were not required to comply with the Administrative Procedures Act. It went up to the Court of Appeals, who said they didn't have jurisdiction. That was appealed to the Supreme Court, who issued an order that sent it back to the Court of Appeals and said essentially, yes, you do decide the case on the merits. A year passed after oral argument, and in September, the Court of Appeals issued an opinion that the Rules Review Commission does have authority to review rules promulgated by the State Board of Education and reversed Judge Gessner, the Superior Court judge's decision.
But the appeals court ruling was split 2-1. That means the case is heading to the North Carolina Supreme Court, and soon. Justices will decide whether the Rules Review Commission has authority over rules dealing with state education policy. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The new federal tax plan should mean good news for the North Carolina economy. Why? A panel of economists explained recently during the North Carolina Bankers Association's annual Economic Forecast Forum. Mark Vittner of Wells Fargo in Charlotte says the tax changes have helped boost economic growth projections, which had been set at 2.1% in recent years.
This year we're at 2.7, looking for stronger growth. We think that the tax cuts are going to have a larger impact than what the general consensus is. And we put it at about 0.3% added on to GDP growth. But in a nutshell, this we look for a bigger impact than the general consensus.
Professor John Connaughton of UNC Charlotte points to one piece of the recent tax plan that critics have ignored.
All the naysayers who have been critical of the Trump tax package or the congressional tax package, GOP tax package, have focused on the fact that in the past we really haven't seen a big hit as a result of a decrease in taxes. But in the past two tax decreases, nothing on the corporate side. And this is where this one is much, much different. And it's not the individual income tax reductions that are going to have a big effect on the economy. It is on the corporate side that's going to have a big effect. U.S. companies, corporations have been essentially non-competitive in the world. In the past 10 years, all of our major trading partners except France have reduced their corporate income tax rates during that period of time. Ours is simply out of line with the rest of our global competition.
Vittner says taxpayers and workers will see a real impact.
The real impact is that we're going to free up a lot of capital that's been on the sidelines. I spend a lot of my time working with small and mid-sized companies. That's kind of our bread and butter. And a lot of folks have been substituting labor for capital over the last 8 years because it was more flexible. They had very little faith in the economy. It's also why we had such low productivity growth. And folks were loath to grant wages because they were substituting labor for capital. Investment in long-lived assets, assets that last for 3 years or more, as a share of our economy is the lowest it's been since 1937. And so that's why productivity has been so low. That's also why pay hasn't been increasing. And now that we've cut the corporate rate and put incentives in for capital spending, we're likely to see business investment significantly outpace what we've seen in the last few years. It's done so. That's why the second and third quarter were so strong. Investment spending was about double what it was previously. That was before the tax cut. It was mainly due to a rollback in regulations. So I think that's one big change in behavior. The other is that we're going to see this repatriation of corporate profits from overseas. And you're going to read a lot about this in the papers as more and more companies begin to move capital back to the U.S. And there's a concern that a lot of these folks are going to use it to buy back shares or to pay a dividend. I don't care. That's fine. I mean, it's very simplistic to think that the companies that bring the capital back are going to build factories with it. They may not need factories. So what the tax reductions are going to do is it's going to allow capital to flow to its highest risk-adjusted rate of return, and that more optimal use of capital is going to give us stronger GDP growth.
You're listening to highlights from the North Carolina Bankers Association's annual Economic Forecast Forum. John Connaughton of UNC Charlotte explains one of the major advantages of boosting economic growth from 2% to 3%.
2%, you don't need to do much to maintain your market share. You can substitute labor for capital, and you'll be competitive. If the market picks up a little bit, a few more workers, you're good to go. That's not the case in a 3% growth environment. In a 3% growth environment, you can lose market share quickly. You've got to be on your front foot, and you've got to take some risk. Now, the downside of what this tax plan is likely to generate in the near future, not in 2018 as much as 2019, is the fact that companies are going to start to be a little bit more risky in their decision making, and that might cause a problem down the road in 18 months or 2 years.
NC State economist Mike Walden likes one major omission from the final federal tax plan.
One thing that I might say that the tax plan did is what it didn't do. Early on in these negotiations in the House, particularly, there was talk of an import tax. That didn't make it, and I think that's good. Most of the analysis economists have done, and I've done some for North Carolina, indicate if we were to do that, actually it would hurt our economy, it would hurt job growth, it would hurt GDP growth. So I applaud the tax writers for doing good things, and I agree 100%. I mean, essentially what this tax law does is improve incentives for working, for investing, for producing. And I applaud them for what they did not do.
The tax plan helps boost Walden's projections for North Carolina's annual economic growth.
2.8, 2.9 GDP growth. We'll add 2 million and a half jobs nationwide, maybe another 70,000 here in North Carolina. Unemployment rate by the end of the year for both the nation, North Carolina, down in the mid-threes, 3.5, 3.6.
The Bankers Association's own economist, Professor Harry Davis of Appalachian State University, points to other important pieces of the federal tax plan.
The bill also allows expensing for capital projects. I mean, that's huge, plus the $3 trillion that we're going to get back that's sitting overseas. And like you, I don't care what they do with it. Just get it back over here, buy back stock, put it into plant and equipment, whatever, but at least get it into this country. Business investment was anemic in 2015 and 2016 in this country. Last year, it about doubled from the rate of 2015 to 16. I believe part of that was in anticipation of a tax bill. And now that the tax bill has passed, I think we're going to see a dramatic increase in business investment, which will lead to greater productivity and finally, perhaps, some real growth in salaries and wages in this country.
Will all of these changes lead to higher wage growth? Davis thinks so.
Corporations in the United States are clearly going to have more money to the bottom line. We've already seen some corporations announcing bonuses, particularly those corporations that pay a very high effective tax rate. Now, for those corporations, lowering their tax rates 21% is a real bonus, and they're passing part of that bonus along to their employees. So I think that's a very good thing. There's very little in the bill other than the doubling of the standard deduction will, of course, help people. But beyond that, there's not a lot in it for individual in terms of just the tax benefits. The real benefit will come in stronger economic growth through business investment, greater corporate profitability, and what that means in the job market and in terms of wages and salaries.
Walden says North Carolina will see particular benefits from the federal tax plan.
We're here in North Carolina, and everything we said about the nation and the positive benefits of this tax bill on the economy goes double for North Carolina in the sense that we are one of the states that's been growing faster than the nation. Just yesterday, I received a report that from United Van Lines saying I think we rank eighth among the states in the nation in terms of net in-migration in 2017. People are still moving here. They see opportunities. They see a lower corporate state tax rate here in North Carolina. So this is bullish for the nation, and it's very bullish for North Carolina.
Vittner of Wells Fargo says the wage growth issue extends to more than just Charlotte and the Triangle.
I think it will lead to wage growth, and we have seen stronger wage growth in the Triangle, where the unemployment rate's at 3.7 right now. Wage growth is up better than 4% year to year, so we've got twice the wage growth that the nation has. So we are seeing that, and I think that parts of the country that have been growing rapidly are going to grow a bit faster, but if you look at where the incentives are in this, with the tax cuts and the tax reform, it's going to boost capital spending. That's going to lift parts of the Midwest and parts of the South that really didn't see a lot of growth in the early part of this expansion in the expansion so far. And so it should lift areas. It should help broaden growth. And that's something that's been missing in North Carolina. There are a lot of industries that are outside of the Triangle in Charlotte that are going to see some real benefits as we see increases in capital spending.
That's Mark Vittner of Wells Fargo, one of the featured speakers at the North Carolina Bankers Association's annual Economic Forecast Forum. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. Now, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. How much does it take to run the state of North Carolina? Well, just over $23 billion when it comes to the state's general operating fund for this year. As the North Carolina population grows, we're over 10 million now, there are demands for more services and pressure from advocates and elected officials alike to spend more money. Our next guest has some educated advice for policymakers as they face these pressures. Joe Coletti is Senior Fellow for the John Locke Foundation. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Always glad to be here.
So the state budget director, a gentleman named Charlie Parruse, he gave an end-of-year assessment several weeks ago, talked about where the state stands in financial terms. Tell us about what he said, and then let's talk about your reaction to it.
Sure. Charlie, the budget director, talked about the slow revenues that we've seen so far this year. According to the General Assembly's fiscal research, we're about $90 million behind schedule, which is not a lot in terms of a $23 billion budget, but it is something that people are starting to take a look at. And then he added what an effect tax reform since 2013 has had, and added some of the ideas that the governor has for spending for next year, about $500 million of new spending. If you take a look at all of the ideas that they were mentioning in the press conference, a lot of it on headlines that, you know, the crises of the day, the hurricanes, the opioid crisis, the prison safety issues, but no details on any of that, just roughly $500 million of new spending that they would like to have.
Joe, you mentioned something really interesting about $90 million or so right. behind in terms of projections of where revenue should be right now. So should we be concerned about that?
Well, we should always be concerned about where when revenue is coming in. But last year, it was a different kind of year, especially towards the end of 2017, because we had Washington going through major tax reform. And news article and investing articles started to talk earlier, as early as November, and probably a lot of folks were taking a look at their money even earlier than that, but taking a look at how do you plan your income for the year. And so people started to, if they had the option to hold off invoices, if they were an independent business, or if they had some kind of large check coming in, they started planning on maybe I can take that in early 2018. And so incomes at the end of last year were probably suppressed a little bit, and we should start seeing that this year. In addition, a number of companies at the end of December said that they would start providing raises and bonuses to employees, and so there may be higher paychecks on that side, which those get withheld, right? That becomes the regular payments for this year. So we shouldn't be concerned yet in terms of what the budget picture is going to look like. If numbers are still behind schedule this month and in February, and especially by the time we get to April, then that's when you start to have to do things. But right now, no, $90 million is well within the range, and given whatever was happening up in Washington, you would expect numbers to be a little lower for.
Well, will we see a surge in state revenues once we get into kind of the heart of tax time as people start saying, okay, I've got a bill to pay to the state of North Carolina, so here's my check?
That's always the hope, right? That's folks who take a look at the budget talk about the April surprise, because in April, that's when the final payments on estimated taxes are due. And so those can come in. And so if people had a good 2017, then you end up with a lot of extra payments at the end because you don't want to pay, right? Everybody who has a refund, we start filing in January, February.
Right.
When the years that we have to pay, we hold off until April 15th. So that's where the real measure comes in. But we should start to see some differences beginning this month as those raises and bonuses start to kick in, as some of those delayed payments come in. And then in February, when the withholding starts to change.
So this is the revenue side
yeah.
of the equation when it comes to operating state government. But interesting in your writings, and folks can read this at johnlock.org, the headline of your piece is Prepare for the Next State Budget by Focusing on Spending. Yeah. And one of your key messages, Joe, in this piece is, yeah, keep your eye on revenue, but keep your eye maybe open a bit wider when it comes to spending. Why?
Well, just like in a family situation, the spending comes before the taxes, and that's been recognized by everybody from Jean-Jacques Rousseau back in the 1700s to Milton Friedman in the 1970s. That if the government spends money now, they have to pay for it. And whether that's through taxes or inflation or debt, the money's coming somewhere, and debt eventually has to be paid by taxes. So that's why if you can keep spending down now, then you can provide for lower taxes into the future.
So how do we do that then? Because we know we're living in a growing state, and there are those who say, look, you got all these people coming in. They're going to demand services, even if it's the existing services that are in place. More people is going to cost more. Do those people who come in as they take jobs and start paying taxes, buying property, paying property taxes, is what they are paying in, does that cover essentially what it's going to cost to provide them services?
For it depends on who the person is. If they come in with children who enter the school system, if they are older and retired and have some of their income in deferred pensions, whether that's government or military, then maybe not. But for the most part, businesses start to generate income. And the the key thing with all of that is that if we can keep the services, keep the cost of what it takes to provide services, then keep that down, then that's what we can have an impact on. We can't necessarily control who comes into the state, especially if they're coming from another state.
Now, the past few years, some state legislators and then Governor Pat McCrory had really tried to keep spending down, at least the growth of spending down each year. They did a pretty good job, did they not?
They did a terrific job of that. And the concern is that now that we're so far into it and the economy's been doing well for as long as it has, that they might start to accelerate spending a little bit more. I think most of the folks in the General Assembly understand the need to continue the discipline that they've had. So,
what would be your advice then to lawmakers, Joe, as they take a look at this, and how do they avoid that feeling of, oh, we're kind of fat and happy, so why not spend a little bit more?
I guess one way is to take a look at the economy, that it's not growing quite as fast as you would hope on a national basis. And the other thing is to keep taking a look at where you want taxes to be, and that leads to the discipline of taking a look at existing programs, seeing which ones can be cut, and which ones, and taking a look at the efficiencies of the others, and how do you optimize the value that you get from what you're spending.
Well, it's great advice. It's been written by our guest, Joe Coletti. He is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Joe, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.